This is Up By Your Bootstraps from State of Opportunity from Michigan Radio. I'm Jennifer White. The distance between those who do and don't live in poverty is getting harder to breach because it's not just emotional anymore. It's geographic. Poverty in America is growing more and more concentrated, more and more suburban. Ann Kalis runs Starfish Family Services, a kind of one-stop shop for low-income families in Inkster.
It's not like one in five kids in this wonderful community of Inkster is in poverty. It's the norm. It's the majority. So I think that those old tales of pull up your bootstrings, they may have worked where there was an isolated family in poverty with strong supports all around them and great education systems. This is like an epidemic, right? It's the norm in so many of, in too many of our communities. It's not the anomaly where people are, you know, wrapping around that one family that's got the issues this year because someone lost a job. It's an epidemic.
We'll hear more from the folks at Starfish in a minute. But first, why does it matter so much if this idea of a mixed income community is harder and harder to find? Well, Robert Putnam has a few answers. He's the author of the book Bowling Alone, and now he's written a new book about poverty called Our Kids. You know, Bob, during this project, we keep seeing this distance between people in poverty and people who have more financial resources. Has it always been this way?
No, it hasn't, Jen. And indeed, that's a central theme of my new book called Our Kids. The meaning of the term Our Kids has shriveled. Over the last 30 or 40 years, people have begun to define the kids they're responsible for more and more narrowly to mean their own biological kids.
Why do you think this is? Is it because we live in a more segregated society by race and class?
No, I think that's an important part of it, actually. One of the things that's gone along with the growing income gap that everybody talks about in America, the gap between rich and poor, that is how much money they have, it also, what's gone along with that is that we live in different places. And therefore, it's just less likely now that people in the middle or upper class would even know kids from the bottom third of the population. And that's an important contributor to the growing opportunity gap in America.
Why does this space, this distance, matter?
Well, it matters because it's always been the case that, you know, rich kids have more opportunities than poor kids, but that gap is rapidly growing. The gap between rich kids and poor kids on many measures of resources is rapidly growing now. The amount of time that parents can spend with their kids, the amount of money that parents spend on their kids. If you're relatively affluent, your kids are more likely now to be going to school with other affluent kids than was true a generation ago. And if you're poor, your kids are more likely to be concentrated in a uniformly low-income school. And all of those things mean that the American dream, that is the basic idea that everybody gets a fair shot, is just less and less true. I've talked to a lot of national politicians and local politicians from all parties, left and right, Republican, Democrat. Nobody has ever said to me, well, who cares if not everybody has the same chance? The most conservative Republicans I've talked to, nobody has said, well, who cares? They may differ about what to do about it, but they don't differ that this is a big moral problem for America.
You know, Bob, I think we can all identify certain safety nets that we have in our lives. But when we look at low-income families, sometimes we see that lack of safety net as being their own fault.
It could conceivably be said in some cases to be the fault of the parents. It can't possibly be the fault of the kids.
So how do we bridge this gap between what we think and feel about people who are living in poverty and how that plays out in policy?
There's another aspect of this that sometimes people miss. Sometimes people think that if we help a poor kid, that's going to be bad for my kid. There's some kind of zero-sum game here where if we help a poor kid, that'll be bad for affluent kids. That is completely wrong. All of the rigorous economic evidence shows that helping poor kids helps the whole economy. And big time, that is to say, the lifetime cost to the U.S. economy, to all kids, to my grandchildren, of not investing adequately in poor kids is something like $7 trillion. And therefore, my kids, who are going to be well-educated and are coming from affluent backgrounds, my grandchildren, I mean, they are going to be worse off because they're going to be living in a poorer society. I don't just mean morally. I mean materially poorer society if we don't have the contributions of these poor kids. So it's not just a matter of morals. It is, of course, a matter of morals. But it's also a matter of self-interest. Michigan is going to be a poorer place. Every place in Michigan is going to be a poorer place if Michigan doesn't invest adequately in poor kids, because therefore those kids are not going to make the contribution that otherwise they would to the whole Michigan economy.
So while we may feel a distance, we're really all in this together.
Absolutely. That's of course a moral point, but it's also a fact.
Robert Putnam is the author of Our Kids, and he says we're just not doing enough to bridge this huge and growing gap created by income inequality. And the folks at Starfish Family Services in Inkster that we heard from earlier, when we went to go and visit them, they totally agreed. But they also know how hard it is to convince people, even their own staff, about the best way to break the cycle of poverty.
I'm Ann Kalis, the CEO at Starfish.
And I'm Heather Brown, and I'm a manager here working on our parent strategy.
The concern about the differences between poor people and middle class people, how does that show up in your work?
It shows up in our staff. You know, most of our staff are young, middle class, you know, people that have not lived in this community or necessarily come from poverty. Not all, but for them it's more like they don't have enough money, as opposed to it being a culture and multi-generational and how a person can move from a poverty class to a middle class isn't as easy or as simple as just, oh, if I just get a good job, then I'm golden. And, you know, so we have to work with staff to show them those things and give them a different experience so that they can be more open to the work that they're doing with the families.
We started in a place where we thought success was just about economic success, and we realized that family success is very multidimensional. It could be about your child's development. It could be about mental well-being, really an assessment of all kinds of life resources, whether it's social-emotional resources, faith as a resource to draw upon, family, and so many of the people that we're working with, a lot of their resource buckets are nearly empty. They may have one or two that have strengths to draw upon to try to even get onto that path to get through school and go to college, but there's a lot of work to just even get many of the families that we work with onto that path.
You've taken a more comprehensive approach to what success looks like for your families, and that it's not just economic gain. I don't think that policy nor public opinion has caught up with that. So does that impact your work, and that you're saying, okay, maybe it's not about having the house behind the white picket fence?
Quite honestly, it's really hard to fund the work that is probably the most important work that we do, which is this gray area of working with families to help them stabilize, to help them gain self-esteem, a support system. That, to me, is the most important foundational work. And I think we have confidence, even though we may not have the money to do these big longitudinal studies, that even if we're working with a family over 3 years, and at year three, they're not at economic self-sufficiency, but we can see they've stabilized their house, they've gotten their child into quality childcare, they are working on mental health issues. We have so much confidence that 20 years from now, they will be at a place of better economic self-sufficiency. But the fact that we can't prove that right now to legislators, we are always like scraping the barrel for funding to do this this work, which is really around relationship building and helping parents just get onto a path where they feel they can grow as human beings and build their capital in all these different areas and eventually get to economic self-sufficiency. In our state right now, there hasn't been a lot of public appetite to fund these really investment-oriented prevention type programs that are about keeping families together and building their resources.
When you run up against either, you know, policy resistance or an inability to get funding for some of the programs you'd like to do, is part of it because there isn't this straight line
short line path to success for families, but it really is about a longer term investment.
I think so. I mean, people are looking, people meaning funders and investors are looking for payoff to see short-term results. And I think we know, even if we just look at early childhood, you don't see the payoff from a quality early childhood program for 15, 20 years. I think we lack that research around how we work with parents and investing in adults so that they can achieve their own goals. We've figured out, based on some research that was started 40 years ago, how to measure children, but I don't think we've quite figured out how to work with parents or adults.
Anne and Heather are really careful about how they think about success for the families they serve. It's about total resources, not just money. So when we imagine what success looks like for these families, would we recognize it if we saw it? Chris Reynolds is the first person in his family to go to college. He thinks a lot about if he's successful, and he also thinks a lot about poverty, and especially the word poor.
I'm a junior here at the University of Michigan, and I'm actually not from Michigan. I'm from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and I'm an aerospace engineering major. So my first internship was after my freshman year. My paychecks were actually larger than like my parents, actually almost combined. So I kind of realized, like, wow, you know, I'm making money that it could definitely help support and give back to my parents. And then now this summer, I'm going like really, really far away. I got an internship, which is sort of my dream internship. I've always really looked to getting this job, which is actually out in the West Coast. It's in Palmdale, California, working for Lockheed Martin. So right now, I'm really on the edge of, you know, looking towards my graduation because I'm a junior now. I realized I think I need to decide first whether I want to go closer to home or if I'm okay with being further from home. I used to think that for me, success would be, you know, going off to college someplace like far away, getting a good job and like moving away from home. And, you know, I didn't really realize going away to college that I have such a strong pull to go back to my family now. I feel like success for me is now defined as, you know, help my success kind of carry my family on a little bit. Because, I mean, my parents have done a lot to be able to get me to this point. Like, I sort of want to give back to them. And, you know, I didn't really realize going away to college that I have such a strong pull to go back. I actually remember saying one time or two that I'm poor. Maybe to my parents I said that for sure. Like, we're poor, you know, we can't do this type thing. I remember saying that specifically. But now I'm, like, so grateful for where I am right now. And that's why I would never define myself as poor at all. I think poor is just such a loaded word and such a negative word as well.
Like Chris Reynolds, Haas Abraham is, by all accounts, a success story. But that doesn't mean it's a simple story.
My life up until this point has been constant striving just to get to a better place. And I'm now 31 years old, and this might be the first time that I've really had that opportunity to be like, oh, I kind of made it out, you know, and it took this long, you know, to finally feel like I can breathe. Prior to moving to my neighborhood, I was a skinny little five-year-old. My father lost his job, and then we had to move into public housing. And within a year, I had debilitating asthma. I was put on a steroid regimen for several years that caused me to gain lots of weight. And it changed my life. I never really shook off the weight, and the stress of poverty compounds that. You know, we faced so many challenges that just to get out of that neighborhood was an accomplishment. It was an immigrant neighborhood, which compounded the poverty because the language barrier meant lower access to jobs. There was a lot of barriers to entry to the middle class in the neighborhood. Our school was one of the least funded in the district. It was kind of isolated in this bubble to the south and away from any economic areas that are relevant to the city, so it was considered kind of a second class of Dearborn citizenship. I don't think that there's anything that makes middle class or working class people special or unique. I think it's just, it's easier to not dwell too much on the problem of poverty if you can write it off as simply those people deserve their situation. Those people must have done something wrong to be in public housing, on welfare. But I know in my situation, that's simply not the case. My dad simply lost his job. My mother had a disability. Those are the two most common factors I run into every day in my job. I'm a Social Security attorney, and I help people to appeal their Social Security denials. All it takes is one layoff, one health crisis to cause you to lose your situation, your status in life, and to fall down the slope of poverty. And so many studies show that poverty is a generational problem. Once you fall into poverty, you often don't climb out for a long time. And this actually leads to why I do what I do. I can't fix people's health. If they're disabled, the money's not going to cure that. But it will lessen the burden on their families and hopefully improve the livelihood for their children, which is what happened to me. My mother is disabled. After fighting for disability benefits for several years, she finally won and allowed us to put a down payment towards the house. It was only when I was a teenager in high school that I was finally able to move out of public housing. And that was the step in my life that really turned things around. Coming up the way I did, I see that a lot of people went out of their way to help me. Counselors and teachers and physicians, and I feel a sense of obligation to repay that. And I also feel in another sense that I have a certain sense of class loyalty. I never want to shake off my identity because I'm proud of my family. I don't think I was raised in an inferior way than anyone else. I just think that we face more challenges.
That was Haas Abraham. He still has a foot in both worlds, and he still feels that distance between them. As we've heard, this distance isn't just about how we feel or what we say in the comments section. It's about who we live around. It's what we tell ourselves about how to make it out of poverty and the stories we tell ourselves about people who haven't made it out. Share your thoughts with us on Facebook. Just search for State of Opportunity. You can also tweet us at State of Op with two P's. If you want to continue the conversation about what you've been hearing today, we're having a special listening session on Thursday, April 23rd at the Ann Arbor District Library. You can find more information at michiganradio.org. Up by Your Bootstraps, a State of Opportunity special from Michigan Radio, was produced by Sarah Alvarez, edited by Zoe Clark, with production help from Annie Norris and Brittany Bartkowiak. Special thanks to the First Gens, a group of first-generation college students at the University of Michigan, for sharing their stories with us. I'm Jennifer White.
Support for State of Opportunity comes from the W.K. Kellogg Foundation, a partner with communities where children come first.